Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the IDEA podcast, brought to you by the Irish Development Education Association. I'm your host, Maximiliana Mtenga. In today's episode, we are going to talk about climate justice and intersectional feminism. And our guest today is Sumaya Muhammad, who is a passionate young climate justice activist in Ireland with a proven history of mobilizing and inspiring change. She co-founded the Students' Climate Action Network, SCAN, a national network for students and teachers advocating for climate justice, which earned her recognition alongside her colleagues. Her work not only focused on empowering young people to become active citizens and advocating for policy change to address the climate crisis, but also ensuring quality climate education for all. She has recently been elected as Associate General Secretary for Global Organization Somalis for Sustainability and is an advisor to the Youth Climate Justice Research Project. Welcome, Sumaya, and thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Sumaya, could you start by sharing your initial experiences with climate justice activism?
So I got involved in kind of climate, well, I guess I was 12 when I first got involved. And prior to that, I wasn't like super involved in anything. Like both of my parents were kind of advocates for human rights and whatnot. I wasn't myself. I mean, I was 12 years old. And then I went to my secondary school and I was really lucky to be able to receive like a climate education. And then one of my teachers was like, anybody who's interested in the environment or anything to do with this, come to this room and we'll just talk about it. So I went because I was always like kind of an outdoorsy person. So I was like, yeah, I like going outside. And then that's when I kind of really learned about the kind of crisis as a whole and how nearing it was to our present. Not even nearing, I mean, it is in our present right now. It's happening all over the world, whether it's in extreme events or kind of minute ones. But that's when I really learned about it and I kind of got really scared. I was like, oh no. So that's when I was like, okay, if I'm this scared and a bunch of other people are scared as well, let's just talk about it together and see what we can do. So that's what we did. And then we co-organized the mass climate protests in Cork. So we thought maybe like 300 people would come, because he was only like 12 to 14 year olds in a classroom every Wednesday at lunchtime and after school just organizing. And then we were super duper surprised when we saw like 5,000 people show up. We were like, oh my goodness, this is insane. So that's when we kind of really got the ball rolling, and that's how I ever since just been doing things, because I think I felt a massive unfair but also like nonetheless it was present responsibility on my shoulders to actually try do something. And I guess that's why I continue to do things today, because I don't think I can just sit around and complain about it and be scared if I'm not going to do anything to try help it.
Yeah, thank you so much. You spoke of like feeling the need to do it, like feeling the responsibility on your shoulders. That is happening right now, especially for young people. We are feeling like we can take part, and that is very positive. And when did you begin to see the intersectionality with feminism, and why is it crucial to discuss these topics within climate justice?
Honestly, it was quite later, which is a bit embarrassing. But I guess I always realized how intersectional of an issue climate change was. I mean, that's quite obvious to a lot of people if you're involved in it or if you're not. I mean, it's going to affect women and young girls and all these type of things much more than it's going to affect the average person, whether it be through access to education or whatnot. And so that's always been present in my mind. But I guess when I really learned about this is a crisis, not actually caused by all the things that they're telling us, when I was 16, and I was just about to head off to COP27, and I was going on behalf of my organization, Students Climate Action Network, at the time. One of my volunteer teachers there showed me this video by Vijay Prashad, and he was speaking at the COP26 People's Plenary, and he was talking about how the climate crisis was an issue made by colonialism, and how that's what it stems from, and how the climate movement in the West is a Western movement advocating for fighting for the future, when it's actually there's thousands of billions of people who can't eat today, and how does fighting for the future stand to a child who hasn't eaten in weeks. And that's when I was like, oh my days, like this, what we're advocating for when we chant climate action, we shouldn't be chanting climate action, we should be chanting climate justice. To make sure, then coming back to your question, like that women and young girls and all these type of people who are disproportionately affected by this crisis are not left behind, because these people are going to be affected more. And that's, I guess, when I went to COP27, I learned about the different constituencies, these UNFCCC conferences, and there's a women and gender constituency, and I went to a couple of their seminars and plenaries, and I really learned about the kind of intersectionality there between feminism and climate justice, and how fighting for one is fighting for the other. I was so enthralled by all of these type of different constituencies, seeing how interconnected everything is. And I guess I was, maybe it was a bit late, but I was also only 16. That's when I kind of, my eyes were opened to how fighting for anything that's injustice is fighting for something else.
That is very insightful. What challenges does climate justice activism face, particularly from an intersectional perspective? And as a young activist, is it our goal to have everyone adapt our perspective, or is there a different approach we should be taking?
To answer the first bit, there's two. I think there's two. One of them is burnouts, and the next one is access to spaces. In regards to the first one, I mean, it's so inevitable. When you're fighting for anything, it's such a taxing mentally and physically and time-wise thing to do, and it's often a lot of the time free. You know what I mean? So, like, especially for young people, they're doing a lot of these type of things for no charge. In comparison, then when you see someone older maybe fighting for it, they're being offered a payment for their time. That's another kind of aspect to the burnout. And then another aspect is that it's just really long and strenuous and mentally taxing. And I mean, anybody would get burnt out from it. And I think a lot of young people maybe don't really realize I actually can take time off. It's actually okay if I do that. And in fact, it'll probably make my advocacy much better in the future if I take a couple of weeks or months off for myself and look after myself. So I think that's one thing that is kind of like a lot of the challenges facing a lot of young climate activists, and also eco anxiety. I mean, we're not on the best trajectory right now in regards to fighting for the climate crisis. And that's no fault of our own primarily. I mean, we know who are the big polluters, and we know what are the kind of things exacerbating this crisis. But I mean, it can have that kind of sense of impending doom, which I know it isn't. I mean, there's still hope. I mean, I wouldn't be doing this if I thought that we were all just screwed. Like, I wouldn't really be bothered. But I know that we're not, and that's why there's hope there, and you have to make your own hope. And I guess the last bit that I think what challenges a lot of young climate activists is access to spaces. I mean, going to a COP conference is no easy feat. Like, getting a badge, a pass to it, very difficult. Getting accommodation, so expensive. Unless you're being funded, you're gonna have to self-fund that. The majority of climate activists might be teachers, not teachers, might be young students and whatnot, and it's really expensive. And then also, when you're there and you have your flights and everything like that booked, that's one hurdle to get through. Now you have the hurdle of actually being able to participate meaningfully without being the door being shut in your face. And these type of things are so difficult to overcome. But then I guess you have the community when you're at COPs to actually help you go through it, and that's a kind of positive in that regard. And I think your second question was, do we have to have people adapt the same approach that climate activists are doing right now? I think it's difficult to kind of categorize the approaches into one kind of lane. The approach that we saw primarily in kind of like the rise of climate movements in 2019 was protesting. And I think now that we've seen like a lot of the things that we were protesting for, like for example, a climate emergency, all these things, they've been achieved. I guess ever since the pandemic, the protesting kind of thing has gone a bit down. And that doesn't mean that the people in climate activism have, the numbers have gone down. I mean, the numbers have gone up extremely. I think it's just because people are finding different ways to approach this. Whether it be through lobbying, whether it be through going to COP conferences, whether it be through organizing, kind of making new organizations, helping young people, all these type of things. So I think there's so many different approaches because it's such a multifaceted issue. Like, it's super nuanced, so you need a nuanced approach. So I don't think you can like categorize it into one thing. But yeah, I think what we're doing now, I mean, it's working. We're pushing for change. So
Thank you so much for that insight, Sumaya. And how has the mainstream environmentalism left marginalized groups behind? And what can we do to amplify diverse voices in climate justice activism?
there's a huge gap there. I was only really like super opened my eyes to it in 2022 when I was going to COP27. I mean, like, a lot of climate protests used to be chanting was climate action now, and when it should be climate justice now. And it's not a fight for our future, it's a fight for the present, for billions of people around the world. And even though we're not facing the kind of huge effects of climate change, we're still seeing it here, but it's peanuts in comparison to other countries around the world, especially in the global south. And I think mainstream environmentalism now is becoming a lot more tuned in to how it cannot afford to be leaving countries in the global south and marginalized communities behind in the fight for climate justice, because first of all, their countries are what have been our historical protectors of the environment. Historically, countries in the global south, their indigenous communities, their cultures as a whole, like I know that my family is from Somalia, culturally it was rooted in environmentalism protection. If you're going to do something to the earth, you got to give back. It has to have a cycle. It can't be something that's going to harm it. And then we see with the effects of colonialism and globalization, these kind of things being like ripped away from their hands. And I guess that's what the climate movement I've found has been a lot more tuned into, kind of the roots of this crisis. And I guess now what we're seeing is mainstream environmentalism ensuring that they don't leave people behind, is doing things like, let's say, making sure that people from MAPA areas are getting access to COP venues, making sure that people from MAPA areas are having more kind of vocal kind of roles in these kind of things, and making amplifying them, because it's not just about having them there and having them sit down, whatever. It's making sure that they're present and speaking. And if they're not able to be there, you make sure that you raise their voices to the highest degree that you can. And I think that's what mainstream environmentalism is trying to do now, but there's a bigger push needed, and I hope that will come in the future. I really hope, or even now, like I really hope it comes now, but I think there's a lot of work being done for that right now.
I couldn't agree more. I think you mentioned a very important point there, Sumaya, about the Global South being the pioneers of environmental protection. For example, the Maasai people who are living in the protected areas, they have been at the forefront of protecting the environment. And as you mentioned, their culture itself protects the environment. They know the environment very well. They know the cycle of it. They know what to do and what not to do within the environment. They are not necessarily there to just destruct and destroy everything just because they are living within those protected area. If I might ask a follow-up question there, how about the involvement of people with disabilities in fighting for climate justice as well?
I mean, it's obvious that there's a huge gap there with making sure that people with disabilities, whether it be physical or anything else, have a space in these places. The COP venues and whatnot, so inaccessible. Like, in not in regards to just like the accessibility in regards to ramps and stuff like that, okay, but in terms of like making sure that, okay, maybe there's a sensory space for people with maybe neurodivergency or whatnot, making sure that there's kind of these kind of spaces for people to kind of cool down if they have like a bit of an overload. And I think there's a huge gap there. I mean, I'm not neurodivergent, but I even find those kind of places is really overwhelming and like a lot of sensory overload, and I can't imagine what somebody else might feel like when they're there. I mean, it's insane. I think I was at one of the people's plenaries in when 2022, when I was at COP27, and there was someone from that constituency speaking, saying that the fight for the rights for disability, for people with disabilities, is the fight for climate justice and ensuring that they don't get left behind in the conversation as well. So I guess there's a huge push to be made there, to be honest.
So, as climate justice activists within the global citizenship education sector, how can we move beyond debates and discussions to ensure effective and inclusive climate action?
I think like my key area of focus in regards to climate action and activism and whatnot is in regards to climate education, because I mean, I got involved through climate education, and I think it is the tool that we can use to ensure that people actually take action in regard, not just mere discussion. And I think that's by empowering and advocate. Like, I think when I was younger, I was very shy. I didn't even like speaking in front of classrooms when I was smaller. And then in secondary school, I had a teacher who believed in me more than I believed in myself. And she told me, no, you can do it. Like, if you really don't want to do it, that's fine, but I think you can do it. And I kind of just needed that little push. I mean, I was quite young. And then that's how I kind of like, I was like, you know, yeah, I can do this. And learning about climate activism, not just a scientific lens, but also kind of through the advocacy lens and the human rights lens and the social lens, that's how I really like, okay, I'm doing something. I'm actually going to take climate action. I'm not just going to sit here and talk about it with my friends. And I think that's the key for actually empowering young people and everybody in society to actually take climate action, because I really do believe that if anybody actually knew the seriousness of the situation at hand, if they really truly knew, then they would take action. And I think that's where the gap is, and that's where we can kind of make sure that people are taking climate action and engaging not just in meaningful discussion, but also trying to create change actively.
That's very insightful, and looks like the seed was planted in you at a very young age. So, and the last question is, what can educators do practically if they want to close potential gaps when we educate about climate change and climate justice?
I think it's just including, to be honest, everything that we've talked about today, not just the science aspect of it, but also talking about the historical cause of the climate crisis, talking about the present implications, not just for us in Ireland, but also for the people in the global south, all that kind of things, and making sure that the conversation is rooted, amplifying marginalized communities and showing them then practical solutions to these things, and also showing them what we can do here in Ireland to ensure that we have no part to play in this crisis, and ensuring that we become kind of leaders in the climate action or climate justice movement. Because, like, Ireland is a really small island and it's really beautiful, and we have a lot of rich kind of culture and biodiversity and all these type of things. And it's a really big shame that we've become so entwined with being the kind of exacerbators of this crisis, but I really do think that we can do a lot more. It's very practical. Like, the things that we can do here in Ireland are super practical and they're super doable. And I think by climate educators showing that we can be the pioneers in this learning about in climate action, teaching them about it with a marginalized kind of amplification kind of those voices, viewpoints, showing them the historical cause of this crisis, and then kind of not rooting that also with the science behind it. I think they're the kind of approaches that we can take to actually create meaningful climate action and educating properly and well about this crisis. People will understand if you're passionate about it or not. And I think by having teachers and educators who are truly passionate about it and actually care will rub off on young people and students of any age. And people will kind of gauge that. I mean, we're all humans. We all, to a certain extent, feel what other people are feeling.
Thank you so much for joining us, Sumaya. Many thanks for our listeners for tuning in to this edition of the IDEA Podcast, the National Network for Development and Global Citizenship Education in Ireland. You can learn more about IDEA by visiting www.ideaonline.ie. This episode is funded by the Irish Aid at the Department of Foreign Affairs. Irish Aid is the government's overseas development program. Irish Aid also supports global citizenship education in Ireland to ensure learning and public engagement with global issues. The ideas, opinions, and comments herein are entirely the responsibility of the Irish Development Education Association and do not necessarily represent or reflect the Department of Foreign Affairs. Police.